නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු ආරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු ආරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු ආරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස ඉමස්මින් සති ඉදං උපජ්ජති ඉමස්මින් සති ඉදං උපජ්ජති ඉමස්ස ඉමස්මින් සති ඉදං හෝති ඉමස්ස ඔව් I used to know this so well ඉමස්මින් සති ඉදං හෝති ඉමස්ස upada idam upajjati imasmin asati idam nahuti imasa niroda idam nirojjati iti. So that was the formula for idapachayata, called specific conditionality is the translation, idapachayata, and is a summary of the principle of dependent origination. And that's something I wanted to talk about a little bit this evening. Not to talk in too much detail about dependent origination, but just to offer a few reflections on what I see as the essence of that principle, idea, teaching, and how it applies in our meditation. The basic idea with dependent origination is observing patterns of how things occur. When, if you look carefully at that phrase, or that formula, imasmin sati idam hoti, when this is, that is, imasupada idam upajjati, with the arising of this, there's the arising of that. Imasmin asati idam nahoti, when this is not, that's not. Imasanyuruda idam nirujati, when this ceases, that ceases. So it's pointing to the presence and the absence, the appearance and the disappearance of what, well, we haven't got to that stage yet of disappearance of what, but just appearance and disappearance. It's often said that this is an understanding of causality, which in a sense is correct, but it's interesting if you look at the way that is phrased. It's not about looking at causes as such, it's about looking at phenomena. It's about looking at what actually appears. Then when we look at the more detailed teaching on dependent origination, I ask, well, what are those things whose origination and dissolution that we're supposed to be contemplating? Then they are, of course, the phenomena that we experience, those things which are directly realizable, knowable with the mind, feeling, consciousness, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, the senses, craving. And so we have these forces or activities called sankharas, which are constantly making up the fabric of our consciousness. And so dependent origination is about looking at how these things happen and discerning the patterns. So there's a little bit more to it than simply watching rise and fall. Watching rise and fall is like a preliminary stage in the development. You watch something, it comes up and then it disappears. But with understanding dependent origination, then we understand the patterns, and we understand the patterns in a useful way, in a way that allows us to, in a sense, have a mastery of them, or to escape. We're not under their dominion anymore. If we give just an ordinary world example of this, it's easy enough to see from day to day the changes in the weather. One day it might be warmer, one day cooler, one day dry, another day rainy. And anyone can observe this. The animals observe that, and they change their behavior accordingly. But it's a lot more difficult to observe the patterns of the changes of the seasons, and to understand that most of the time in this year it'll be wet, and other times of the year it'll mostly be dry, and some times of the year it's mostly warm, other times of the year it's mostly cold. And these are empirical facts, but they're not so obvious. They're not directly evident to our senses in the same way as a warm day is. We can walk outside and anybody can see it's a warm day. But if you want to say summer is warmer than winter, that's not something you can directly experience with the senses in the same way. It's something you have to infer. It's a pattern that we learn. And we either learn that ourselves, or it's passed down through culture. And of course, that's largely what culture and language is the ability to pass down what they call in the Indic sphere the Veda, the knowledge. And so you pass down the Veda, the knowledge, from one generation to the next. And so you have this knowledge in the culture of, for example, the seasons and the regularity of these things. Now, choosing the seasons is not an arbitrary example. The word for season in Pali is utu. And that is related to the Vedic word rita. And rita meaning the seasons, but having a more general meaning of the patterns or the order in nature. So this is something that's very important, and something that we perhaps don't appreciate enough in our modern times. We're used to the idea that we can control nature. We can turn the heater on if it's cold. We can turn the aircon on if it's hot, if we're lucky enough to have those things. Not necessarily at Santi that you have those luxuries, but nevertheless, you get the idea. So we think we can control nature, but of course for either animals or for people living in much simpler societies, of course you have much less control over nature. I mean, of course, even our control over nature is very limited, but it's more than most cultures have. And so it's quite a revelation to understand that these things have a pattern, that there is an order to the cosmos, there is an order to the universe. And we're not just at the whim of the inscrutable forces of the rain, the thunder, and so on. But we can actually understand the patterns, and we can change our life accordingly. It means we can plant our crops at the right time. We know when to sow the seed, we know when to harvest it, we know when to keep it. And of course, that with all the changes that makes in possible in human society. So, understanding these patterns is something that's very, very profound. Gives us very, very, very powerful. So, in dependent origination, we follow a similar kind of progress, that we start out with observing those things that are occurring in our consciousness. We see the feeling, understand it for what it is. If you're sitting in meditation, it's the pleasant feeling of metta, or the pleasant feeling from anapana, or maybe the painful feeling of sore knees or sore back or whatever, or the kind of the dull, unpleasant feeling of being tired, or there's some kind of emotional feeling of anxiety or whatever. And so these are feelings. We perceive them in the present moment. And this is the basis of developing insight meditation, any kind of insight meditation. So when we're doing any kind of vipassana, we choose some kind of framework or method that's going to give the mind some direction, some stability, so that it can perceive these arisen qualities, the phenomena in the mind. So as we're sitting here, we can all feel the pressure of the seat that we're sitting on, the cool feeling of the air on our face. We can hear the gentle sound of the rain outside. All of these are arisen phenomena. They're present to our mind. So when we're starting our vipassana meditation, this is what we contemplate. We contemplate these feelings, these sensations, and we make them as clear to the mind as possible. And of course that's why it's always very useful to develop our samatha as best as we can. And that gives us the clarity and the steadiness. So we're watching, understanding these things. And as we do that more and more and more, we start to gradually get a sense for the patterns, for the unfoldings of things. Not just a feeling, but you start to see, how do I respond to that feeling? Feeling comes up in the body, maybe a feeling of pain in the back. How do I respond to that? What kinds of thinking does that tend to provoke? What kind of perceptions? What kind of emotional response do I have to that feeling? Do I feel fearful? Am I worried about it? Am I anxious? Do I just not have any emotional response? Do I just see it with equanimity? Does it make my mind kind of worried and sort of, you know, wanting to know how I can fix it and solve that problem? Do I get annoyed and start thinking, well, I could only meditate better if I didn't have this pain in my back? Or does it not really affect me too much? So this is, you're starting to understand these patterns, cause and effect. One thing happens and then another thing happens. And when we first observe these things, we can't necessarily discern the patterns. And it's very easy, in fact, to mistake false patterns. And just like if you're observing the weather, you can observe the weather for many days and still not understand the cycle of the seasons. It's very easy to be thrown off. Maybe one winter is unusually dry, and then you conclude that the winters are dry. So it's very easy to be thrown off, especially if you don't have enough information. So this is why we just need to keep on with the contemplation, keep on contemplating, keep on observing the patterns, observing the responses, observing the relationships. This happens and then that happens. We don't think about it, you're not sort of making a theory about this, you know, this kind of feeling tends to stimulate this kind of cognition. We're not making a psychological theory in that way, but we're observing how our mind works. And as we do that, then gradually an inferential understanding arises with the suttas they call anvayajnana. Anvayajnana is the knowledge of inference, the knowledge of how things follow on from one another. Literally, anvaya means following on. So we have the sense, impact, sights, eye consciousness, eye contact gives rise to feeling. Feeling gives rise to craving. Craving gives rise to grasping. So what's going on here? What's going on with craving and grasping? Well, the basic difference, just to put it very simply, is that craving is a more more primitive, more basic emotional response. Craving is, animals feel craving in just the same way as people do. sensual craving, or craving to live, or craving to not live. Three kinds of craving. So this is the most kind of basic kind of emotional existential response to things, is through craving. Grasping is more subtle. Grasping is always like the grasping at rites and rituals, grasping at views, grasping at ideas of the self and so on. So upadana or grasping is more sophisticated. Animals don't get attached to doctrines of the self. Animals don't get attached to rites and rituals. But people do. And people only learn these things at a certain time in their life. And when newborn babies, we don't know these things. You know, we're not lying there in our cot being attached to rites and rituals. And we still, of course, you have the anusaya, the underlying tendency, the potential is there, but it hasn't actually manifested. So grasping is more our ideas about things, the theory, it's more cognitive, more intellectual. Whereas craving is more the sort of more immediate, primitive sort of emotional response to things. So when we're contemplating in a meditation, you watch how this sense activity then gives rise to these cravings. And then, of course, the craving gives rise to various kinds of suffering, which we can feel. I'm talking so far about dependent origination. I've been focusing on the middle part of it, from the six senses and so on. And that's the part which is most evident and most apparent for our contemplation. And that's where we should start. These are the things that we should begin with in our vipassana meditation. The other aspects of dependent origination, the ignorance, conditioning, sankhara, giving rise to consciousness and nama-rupa. Or on the other end, the grasping, giving rise to existence and then rebirth and so on. These things are much more subtle, much harder to discern. And we can only see these things through understanding the patterns. We can't observe these things, not all of them, we can't observe them directly in the same way. For example, just an obvious example is aging. It's described in the suttas as like the graying of the hair and the breaking of the teeth and these kinds of things. And this is not something that you can directly observe in your meditation. I can't sit there in my meditation and, well, yeah, my hair's going grey, but I can't sit there and watch that in my meditation. It just is how it is. I can't actually observe that changing. I can't observe my teeth breaking while I'm sitting in the meditation. So this sort of process of aging and death, similarly, we can't observe death simply and straightforwardly in our meditation in the same way that we can observe, say, a feeling of pleasure or a feeling of pain. So our understanding of these things is to some extent inferential. It comes about through an intuitive leap where the mind gets it. Somehow you penetrate, you see what the truth is. And that intuitive leap comes about through a combination of factors. First factor is the use of the intellect. Reading about dependent origination, thinking about it, discussing it, so that we have a clear intellectual grasp of what dependent origination is all about. Then we have the meditative contemplation, those parts of dependent origination that are amenable to direct observation, those parts we observe and we contemplate. We practice those things, we observe them. And then the much, much deeper and much more subtle aspect that really helps us to understand dependent origination is something that is very hard to pin down and something which I don't find talked about very much in discussions of dependent origination, and that is our existential engagement, feeling of existential need. A need to understand, a need to know, a sort of an intuition. We have this intuition somehow that something's wrong with the world, somehow that we're caught, that we're trapped. And dependent origination is an understanding or a framework for us to understand how that entrapment occurs and how we can find liberation, find freedom from that. And so one only comes to understand dependent origination deeply when you really feel that sense of existential need, that kind of drive for understanding and for freedom from the suffering that binds us. And so that's really the most profound motivation that comes. So those other things prepare us. The intellectual or theoretical consideration of it prepares our mind. The investigation through vipassana meditation that prepares our mind. But it's that deep existential longing for freedom, for understanding. This is what brings the deep insights, which actually lead to letting go. And just as when we're practicing, contemplating the readily observable parts of dependent origination, we experience minor and temporary letting go. You watch a feeling in the body and you see the mind getting attached to that and getting caught up and obsessed with that feeling and then able to let go of it, finding equanimity. Then when our intuitive understanding becomes deeper, then those letting goes become much bigger, become much deeper. We're not just letting go of this feeling or that feeling, we're letting go of all feeling. And this is really the critical thing with dependent origination, is that it's understanding sabbe sankhara, all sankharas. Not just this one, not just that one, but we understand the principle, we're able to let go. And so it's that intuitive leap of understanding which goes from our own limited experience towards an understanding of the nature of all experience, the nature of any reality that we might experience. So there's just a few reflections for you for this evening on understanding dependent origination. And the main take-home lesson, if you like, from this is just this, if you can remember those three aspects of learning, understanding dependent origination that I think are very important. The one is a theoretical understanding from study and discussion and thinking. And the second is the experiential and through vipassana meditation. And then the third one is the existential, is one's own inner need to find a solution, find an escape. So I offer this for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
Andres.
Yeah. Probably a bit of both. It's probably.
Well, as you do the investigation, as you sort of get deeper into it, you realize just how deeply in the mire you are.
Yeah, that's true. But I think also, if it wasn't there, you probably wouldn't have started in the first place.
Yes.
But it's something which is much more, harder to pin down. Yeah, than the other things, it's harder to identify. I mean, for myself, I came reading Nietzsche and Kafka and things like that.
Yes, well, for me, I thought I've had that most of my life, but I was trying to figure out exactly.
Yeah, that's right. But the thing is, we have it, but we don't direct it. We don't know where it belongs. We don't know what to do with it. And I think that's the great thing in the West is that, there's a very strong sense of existential unease, and no solutions.
That's why finding the Dharma late in life is such a the other question was about training. I mean, for me, I've been sort of thinking about it quite a bit, practice retreat, because it seems that all of the, I mean, just about, you know, all of the teaching seems to point to that, I mean, the craving, if you eliminate craving, basically, you end suffering. Because, you know, for love and truth, that's what's the suffering. Also suffering, the second opportunity.
Yeah.
So everything sort of, it seems like the whole path is about getting rid of craving. Is that right?
It's one way of looking at it, yeah.
But it's complicated, particularly with craving.
Oh, yeah.
When it talks about, like in the Dhamma chapter, what is sort of about the ending, right? Ending. So ending suffering.
Yeah.
I mean, it talks about, you know, the erosion, all those different similes for, you know, abandoning, cessation, all this stuff. Does that all of it refer to the abandoning or getting rid of craving?
Oh, if you get rid of craving, everything else kind of follows along. It's kind of a domino effect.
I see a dependent origination as the free life model or the one life model. Or is it important?
There's no models. The three life model, and it is important.
What?
Sorry?
Why?
Why?
As opposed to like the one life model.
Well, because the one life model is wrong. So if you understand it in that way, then you misunderstand the Buddha's teaching. I mean the whole purpose of it, or a very large part of the purpose, it's difficult to reduce dependent origination, it has so many different ramifications, but one very large purpose of it is to explain how rebirth occurs without a self. You know, that's brought out very clearly in suttas like Mahanidhamma Sutta and other places that sort of have a close connection between dependent origination and anatta. You just have this huge hole in Buddhism, which, you know, if you take it out. See, the problem is that those kind of explanations are, in a sense, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, of course, you know, if you look at the way that these things happen psychologically, I mean, of course, it's true, you know, but the problem is that's not what it means, you know. And, you know, the obvious one being the birth, aging and death, you know, which Buddhadasa says is like the birth, aging and death of a sense of self. Well, it's obviously not what the suttas are saying. And, you know, if the suttas want to talk about that, they have perfectly good ways of talking about it. That's clearly not what it's meant. So there are plenty of places that talk about the, you know, dependently originated notion of a self or psychological states and attachments. For example, the Madhupindika Sutta or the Sakapanha Sutta and many other places where you get, you know, dependently originated, you know, teachings on that, but it's not the dependent origination and it's not so central as the standard 12 links, which obviously has a special importance. Yeah. So I mean, to use it in different ways as a kind of inspired by is fine, but as long as you don't kind of try to reduce it to those other formulations. I mean, just for one example, I was quite surprised when I was doing this psychology course because they use dependent origination as a model for addiction and for treating addiction, which obviously had nothing to do with what dependent origination actually is. But they seem to use it quite successfully. You know, it seems to actually help, you know. So if it helps, then that's fine, but as long as you don't try to sort of eliminate the more profound understanding of it. Don't you just mean don't try to reduce it?
Also, the way I see it in another tradition, they seem to think the key here is the chain between feeling and craving. And as long as you can watch at this point with equanimity, let go. The whole thing unravels. But the sense I'm getting from the talk here is the whole pattern needs to be understood for this insight to occur. So it's not about some kind of maybe control or letting go. It's actually understanding here. That
well, I wouldn't say control, but I mean it is understanding leads to letting go, but I would agree with that. Yeah, you can't reduce it to just one link. I mean, you're presumably referring to the Goenka tradition. We focus on basically on feeling, and sometimes even to the extent of not just feeling leading to craving, but just understanding feeling itself. I don't think you can reduce it to that thing. Again, why have the whole dependent origination if it's just watching feeling giving rise to craving? And there's plenty of places that talk about that apart from dependent origination. You don't have to use in origination to explain that. But there are a lot of subtleties to it.
Is that because it's not this is I haven't really thought about this question, so it's probably rubbish, but all the linkages in the information, but they're not necessarily linear or two-dimensional, that could all be occurring. Except, of course, I think they are.
Yeah, they have complex relationships.
Yeah.
And there are different, within dependent origination itself, even though it's expressed in a simple linear form, but the factors themselves have very different kinds of relationships to each other.
Because, I mean, even if it actually occurred in a new way, if I'd explained it in a new way, then, you know, breaking one part should cause it all to fall apart. But, you can infer that it, because if it doesn't fall apart, then they must be very complex.
Right.
Also, the
easy people
in life, doesn't it? Yes. So, is it possible to see all of our links in one? I guess it isn't. Sorry.
In one, what, one mind moment?
I guess there's another view which says dependent origination is a structural thing.
It's Nyanavira's idea, yeah. Yeah, and Nyanavira's idea is clearly wrong. I mean, obviously, birth, aging, and death is not meant to be structural and linear. And again, that kind of thing. But on the other hand, other aspects of it are a structural causality. Say the relationship between vijnana and nama rupa clearly is structural, and that's even a simile given in the suttas where the two are leaning up against each other like the two sheaves of reeds. So you know that kind of relationship in that place. The problem with a lot of these explanations is that they're just too simplistic. You know, the fact that there are some of them embody a structural relationship doesn't mean that all of them do. Some of them, the fact that some of them are linear doesn't mean that all of them are. So, you know, in that sense, I agree with the traditional understanding. You know, and that the traditional understanding is to interpret each link on its its own terms, as having its own particular kind of causal relationships with other terms. Yeah, but that's all getting a little bit complicated. I didn't want to do a technical thing on pin origination, but just a sort of more practical.
So maybe a practical question?
Yeah.
In our practice, mm-hmm. when would be the time to maybe do this as a formal investigation?
Well, when you can, I mean, there's no wrong time, but as a general rule, you know, say when you can profitably develop samadhi, then you should always do that. If you can't for some reason, or the mind sort of inclines towards investigation. In the commentaries, they have a threefold division of three kinds of parinya. I'm just trying to remember. I think it's sabhava parinya. I just can't remember the term now. It means scrutiny. I can't remember the Pali word. Sabhava parinya. And then the last one is Pahana Parinya. The Parinya means full understanding. And the first one is essentially seeing the phenomena as they are. Yeah? So it's just watching the feelings or watching the sensations in the body or whatever. So you're just sort of seeing that. And then the next one is the Tirana or something like that, is understanding the relationships and the connections. So it's understanding in terms of, say, three characteristics or dependent origination or something like that. So you're actually understanding the principle behind them. And then the last one is the Pahana Parinya, is the full understanding is letting go. So the basic idea, and I think that particular scheme is a very useful one to bear in mind. First when you're developing it is you understand what there is. And you have to have a clear idea of what there is, and then as that deepens, you understand what's the connection between those things, what's the relationship. And then as it deepens further, you're able to let go of it. So it's not that one of them, you know, doesn't have to be strictly linear, but it sort of makes sense that should be where the emphasis is. So that would suggest that if you're developing vipassana, that in the initial stages, you know, you focus on the things themselves, on the feelings and so on. Don't worry about the causal relationships. But then, when the mind is clear and good, and you can see those things very well, and then you can start to investigate and ask yourself, what's the relationship? What's the connection? And start to investigate that. And if your mind is steady and actually holds that investigation, then keep on going with it. Yeah. And again, that's not, you know, in itself, that's not the same as the intuitive understanding, but that's preparing your mind for the intuitive understanding.
I guess to do this process, then we can't understand the present moment. We have to expand our focus.
Yep.
To be able to make these inferences.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's what the inference does. Yeah. I mean, otherwise you're always stuck with, well, this feels like this. Oh, this feels like this. This feels like this. This feels like this. And there's no connection between one or the other. Yeah? So if understanding causality, you must know, oh, this feeling now because I was thinking like that in the past and not thinking like that in the past. So there's an understanding, reflective understanding. Yeah. And again, this is one of the reasons why it's not purely a structural process. It has an aspect where it unfolds through time. Okay, so let's finish up with these weeks. Just let everybody know that tomorrow we're going to have a large bus load. I see, I believe about 50 people, and I believe that, I'm not sure, all or some of them will be disabled.
53 are going to be. Some, I spoke to them today. A lot of them are carers.
Okay.
Some of the people that we're caring for who have mental disabilities.
Okay.
And there's also some children.
Okay.
Actually, that was the other thing. I was talking about enough to have forgotten about something. And yes, apparently the Archie has spoken to you about it.
Yeah.
They were expecting to be.
Oh, okay. So that's okay then. I was just thinking if there are going to be a lot of physically disabled people, but if that's okay, and if they've got their carers with them, then that's all right. Okay, so let's finish by paying respects.
Bhagavato